down and dirty, ice-bound and pungent, merciless and petty. By these words do I describe London in the 13th century. It would be a most vile prosody if I were to suggest to you, dear listener, that the London of this era we discuss today was a nice location to reside in. It was not. It was an umbral place of cold and brutality, filled with secrets lost to us with the flowing of the years. London in this era is like an ebony pool of water that sits deceptively still off surface, but whose depths are unfathomable, and which holds hidden currents below that dash the unwary on deadly rocks. Book 4 of the story of London I called The Winter Kings, and in many ways the events of these next few years illustrate this thematic device perfectly. This is a story of a few years in the life of the city that are equal parts intimate, fascinating, and dark. It's the story of local politics and natural disasters, how the residents got to partake in moments of cruel pleasure at the expense of the enemies of the realm, yet also the story of a murder and a political cover-up around it. There was a lot going on between 1280 and 1285 in London, not least of which it was during these few short years where the position of mayor was suddenly to be abolished for all time. Only it clearly wasn't for all time, but it was for the next 13 years, and above all, at this moment, no one knew that it would be abolished for only 13 years. For the residents of London, this was it. This was the end of the mayors of London. Which begs the question, how the hell did that happen? What circumstances led to this moment, the fall of the most important position in the city, a moment symbolically suggested when only a short time previous to this, London Bridge itself had seemingly collapsed? Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city as a single narrative tale. Its aim is to try and craft a story over many sections, chapters and books, each part bringing us further along this amazing tale that was to make up the history of this most unique metropolis. And in this chapter, a five-year period of icy weather, disaster on the Thames, and the darkest of murky dealings. This then is part 104 of the story. London Bridge has fallen. We begin this chapter, as it will become important to keep mentioning these things as we go along, with a simple guide to who was in charge of the city as we enter the year 1280. The mayor was an oligarch, Gregory de Rooksale. Alongside him were the two sheriffs of the year, William de Farringdon and Nicholas de Winchester. Nicholas was the alderman of Langbourne Ward, but William was much more interesting. William de Farringdon was a member of the Goldsmiths' Company and had become an alderman of the ward called Ludgate and Newgate, a position he purchased in 1279 from the former alderman, a man called Ralph Flail. The position of alderman for this region stayed with William for many years, and he passed it to his son-in-law Nicholas, and in time this ward became known as Farringdon Ward, and about 120 years from now, sometime in the 1390s, this ward would be divided into two, Farringdon Ward within and Farringdon Ward without. Well, here in 1280, William Farringdon was a newly appointed sheriff of London. I have read from at least one source that only a year or so previously, he'd been arrested during the clampdown and legal pogrom against coin clippers of London. But as he was not Jewish, he had, of course, avoided the mass executions that followed that, and so returned to respectability and remained there. His son-in-law, Nicholas, and yes, he is a son-in-law, but also, yes, he adopted his bride's father's surname, we will meet in the future of the story as a goldsmith and four-time mayor of London. But for here and now, that's the sheriffs and that's the mayor. As well as the leader's political, there was also London's leader spiritual. The Bishop of London in 1280 was a man called John Chissell, but he died on February 7th that year. And there, quietly within the circles of London's ecclesiastical authority, there followed a moment of confusion as to who should follow him. Two prebendaries of St. Paul's Cathedral, a man called Fulke Lovell and another called Richard Gravesend, seem to have been considered as his successor, the two men seemingly navigating both the intimate waters of London's prebendary political climate alongside the national considerations needed to be taken on board before one could hold such an important bishopric. Fulke was the Archdeacon of Colchester and took an early lead, finding himself named Bishop-elect of London on February 18th that year, and he held that post for a month. But he was never consecrated as full bishop and resigned the post of bishop-elect in early April, and Richard Gravesend was made bishop by that August. These brief facts are all we have, but we can surmise behind this was the possibility of months of lobbying, jostling and campaigning by the two candidates. Gregory de Rooksale then was mayor of London, but as we covered last chapter, he was now also warden of the Royal Mint, newly relocated to its safe new location behind the walls of the Tower of London. And as I said last chapter, the transition of power this year from Gregory to the next mayor seems very smooth. Around this mayor and his sheriffs and the new bishop, London was carrying on building and growing. Up in Hackney, you had the Kingsland Leper Hospital, or Lazar House, being built, which was eventually placed under the jurisdiction of the Church of St. Bartholomew down in Smithfield. And also around now, you started to see someone very rich begin making moves into the London property market. There's this man we need to pay attention to, called John de Kirby, and he'd been made Chancellor of England back in 1272, and he arrived in London and began buying up property in Holborn, opposite St. Andrew's Church there. John de Kirby's role in the civil service of King Edward I seems to have really been a man who Edward trusted for serious behind-the-scenes roles of the administration. He was basically a professional civil servant who the king would use to run things when needed, and was subsequently rewarded by the king for his services with church positions he should never have rightfully held. You see, de Kirby was never ordained a priest, he was a deacon, but his efforts over the next few years in gathering monies for the king were so successful, he was eventually given positions like deans and archdeaconries, and eventually he gained the title of bishop. John de Kirby becomes an important figure in London politics over the next few years, and we start his involvement in the story of London by stating that he was buying up property in and around Holborn. In a few years' time, he was to be made the Bishop of Ely, and he left this property in Holborn to the See of Ely when he died, and in time, this would become Ely Palace, a major building in the region. Ely Palace no longer exists, I'm afraid, but Ely Place, the multi-storied terraced houses behind gates over in Camden, next to Hatton Gardens, is built upon the site of where the palace once stood. And alongside that, you have the wonderful little pub, Ye Olde Mitre, along with the old chapel of Ely Palace, the church of St. Ethelreda, and these remain a tangible legacy of John de Kirby. A more substantial legacy was to come in the next few years, but I just need to stick a pin in Kirby's tale. All we need to know that he was a no-nonsense, hard-nosed, political fix-it man for the king, and he had property in North London. But by 1281, the politics of London changed, as Henry Wallis was reappointed mayor, as Mayor Gregory settled back and placed his duties of warden of the Royal Mint in the Tower as priority, and Alderman William Manzier and Richard Clerkenwell became the the new mayor's sheriffs. 1281 was a year of building. We had seen work on the western wall of the Tower of London finally come to an end. Please note, it had been less than 15 years since the last time the tower had actually been besieged, as we covered back in Chapter 99. So we know this expansion work wasn't just for show. But we read now an entry in the French Chronicle of London that demands a bigger explanation, because in just one sentence it conveyed a huge event that impacted upon the whole city. It says that in 1282, quote, "In the same year, London Bridge was broken by the great frost that befell," unquote. So, some context for new listeners and also a reminder for old ones. Ever since 1265, and in response to events covered way back in Chapter 97 of this podcast, London Bridge had been generating cash for the King's mother. That moment back then, when the residents of London had stood atop the bridge and poured scorn and other things upon the Queen as she tried to sail from the Tower of London to Windsor, had seen Edward, first as prince and then as king, insist that by way of compensation, all the revenues generated by the London Bridge, aka the tolls and customs charged to travellers crossing it, should now go to the Queen and not the city by way of compensation. As time had passed, this had caused issues. See, the city paid for the maintenance costs on London Bridge from those self-same tolls and customs. Peter of Colechurch's original plan for the building of the bridge, which we covered all the way back in Chapter 73, had seen it become a remarkably self-sufficient little system. But, as we said, since 1265, these monies had been going to the Queen. Now, I did mention back in Chapter 100, a dozen years previous to this, around 1270, the Queen had seemed ready to hand back that revenue stream to London, as the bridge back then was showing clear signs of wear and tear. It was, after all, only a stone medieval bridge. But, as we said, somebody at the time convinced her not to. And we do know that after all these years, that the bridge was showing serious structural weaknesses, as the city had petitioned the king back in 1280, asking permission to, you know, maybe get those funds back. Edward's response, well, never let it be said he couldn't hold a grudge for years. He refused to grant London the monies generated by the tolls, but he did give them permission to solicit donations from elsewhere to repair the bridge. Yes, you can pay for it, London. But that money, the money from the tolls and customs, that goes to my mother. You remember my mother, don't you, London? What you said to her. What you threw at her. Now, for me, it was about now that the nursery rhyme, or the capture and release folk dance we know as London Bridge is Falling Down, really began. As I covered all the way back in Chapter 29, when I examined the myth that it was based on some Viking attack, the song, known earlier as Dancing the London Bridge or The Building of London Bridge, if it had a moment in time it was fixed upon, if those lyrics referred to an actual event, then for me it would be fixed upon this moment between 1280 and 1282. The lyrics, the endless refrain to My Fair Lady, for me seem to point towards Dowager Queen Eleanor, and the suggestions given to her to, or that she gives to rebuild the bridge, do seem grounded in the reality of the 1280s. Building the bridge up of wood and clay, aka using the old methods, would fail as they would wash away, bricks and mortar will not stay, etc. Of course, you must take on board that all modern transcriptions of the nursery rhyme's lyrics are indeed modern transcriptions. And even if someone like myself maintains the rhyme began around 1280 or thereabouts, I must remind listeners that this is speculation on my behalf, and no actual lyrics exist from this time. Whatever was the case, however, things about London Bridge came to a head over the winter of 1281 and 1282. During this notable winter, a serious cold snap, which we just said was called a great frost in contemporary records, hit London around Christmas of 1281 and remained throughout January, February, and into March of 1282. So cold did it get that the River Thames froze in places, and records suggest that one could walk from Winchester to Lambeth at times. Crucially, however, as the records earlier said, the ice had damaged five of the arches of London Bridge. The French Chronicle said that London Bridge was broken. The idea that five of the many arches had collapsed into the river. And that does seem to be the inference, that the great frost of 1282 had finally broken the weakened bridge over the Thames to a level that it was unstable or damaged to the point where it couldn't be used or where it had actually collapsed. It was this disaster that finally made Edward, King of England, realise that the bridge needed not just repairs but also effective financial management, and so the tolls and duties of the bridge were finally returned to London. But this is King Edward here. His relationship with the city remained fractious, and in the same year, while he gave, he also took. Remember, the new mayor, Henry de Wales, was not a London oligarch who was loyal to the king. He was a loyalist to the king who just happened to be a London oligarch. And his taking office saw not only the king return the rights to the bridge revenues, in the same breath, he seemed to have ordered the mayor to unleash a clampdown on law and order across the city. To quote the records, quote, in this same year, too, the mayor first had the grain weighed when going to the mill, and after that the flour, and had the hurdle provided for drawing the bakers thereon, unquote. That line obviously needs a bit of explanation. What does that have to do with the clampdown on law and order? Well, from 1281 to 1284, the mayor of London, Henry de Wales, who had served Edward in many capacities and had been mayor of London before, as we said, in 1273 to 74, and then moved to serve him in Bordeaux, he was told to take exceptional measures to bring order to London. Regular listeners could remember that a couple of chapters ago, I went over how the king instituted a clampdown on night crime across the country. But as well as that, his successful and highly profitable clampdown on coin clippers the year before seems to have been an incentive for Edward to start looking for criminality everywhere. And the face of his determination to clamp down on London seems to have been personified in Mayor Henry de Wales. Now, that quote refers to him restarting and reinstating the practice of dragging bakers convicted of fraud, aka cutting back on the measures of bread, through the streets of the city. This is why it makes a thing of mentioning him weighing the grain going to the mill and then the flour that comes from that. Short-shifting customers by being parsimonious on the flour in your bread was a thing. And back then, shrinkflation was treated by public humiliation and ridicule. Who says we can't learn from the past? A hurdle was provided, and offending bakers were grabbed and placed into it and led through the streets with musicians playing a song probably called "These Greedy Bastards Rip Off the Public." But Mayor de Wales did more than go after short-measuring bakers. By looking at things that took place, the mayor seems to have been initiating a whole new period of reforms to the city over the next few years. For one thing, he initiated a new watch system. The gates were to be opened during the day, but each was to be manned by two sergeants who were to be, quote, skillful men and fluent of speech, who are to keep a good watch upon persons coming in and going out so that no evil may befall the city, unquote. He also mandated that a curfew bell was to be rung at each parish church, taking the time to ring from the traditional curfew bell of St. Martin's le Grand, and at this time the gates were to be shut as well as all taverns. In each ward, men were to patrol the streets and arrest anyone outside without a good excuse. The Thames was to be guarded, and no one was to cross the river at night. Now, the justification of this night watch was, quote, for the safekeeping and maintaining of his peace, unquote, and that, quote, in each ward, certain persons shall be chosen, up to a certain number, according to the size of such ward, and at times when there is great resort of people unto the city, unquote. So the larger wards had more men, and clearly provision was included in case there was an influx of visitors to the city. What kind of men were needed for Mayor de Wales' new watch? Quote, such persons must be strong and with good arms well able to defend, and shall be presented by the folks of the ward unto the alderman, before whom they shall make oath well and lawfully to keep ward and without favour to anyone or corruption through either gift or affinity, to arrest and attach those who act and go about by night, in breach of the peace and in contravention of the form of the proclamation made, and lawfully to present the same before the mayor, before whom, according to their offence, such persons shall be punished, unquote. So it's not a police force, but it is a bunch of big, strong lads who everybody in the ward would know, local lads looking after local people. Tough enough to look after themselves and honest so they could do their duty, which was, as it said, to arrest anyone wandering about at night, whereupon they'd gather them and present them to the mayor and aldermen of the city to judge. But the watch was a proper community effort, as the rules go on to say, quote, towards the sustenance of such persons, let all such make contribution as are hostlers and housekeepers in such ward, officers of the king excepted, unquote. So the whole ward helped contribute towards their night watch. And it also goes on to say, quote, the arms which they shall have for keeping the watch shall be provided and bought according to ordinance made by the wardens of the city at the cost of the people of the wards, unquote. But included in the rules for the watch is a warning which says, quote, if any of those sworn so to keep the watch shall be attained of not having duly kept watch, or of having shown favour unto anyone whom for his offence ought to have been attached and arrested, by reason of any corruption, affinity or indulgence, or for any reason, let him be punished by imprisonment at the discretion of the warden and of the alderman according to the extent of such an offence, unquote. Then, as now, no one likes a corrupt cop. But there's another reason why this regulation needed to be added. And a clue as to what that reason was lies in the significance that that order tells them to report to the warden of the city. But we'll come to that shortly. So where did the watch take those people who'd been arrested? Well, as we mentioned two chapters ago, a custom-built prison was created in London by Mayor Wales, the Tun Prison. Located over in Cornhill, between Change Alley and Birchin Lane, it was erected in 1283, apparently next to an old well, which later was incorporated into a conduit. It was the place where they took all the night walkers, a term which encompassed both prostitutes and men, quote, taken in fornication, unquote. And it also went on to say that, quote, if any priest be found with a woman, he should be taken to the Tun on Cornhill with minstrels playing before him, unquote. The prison's name derived from its round shape, which looked like an upended wine cask or tun. But it wasn't just night offenders this clampdown that the mayor was directing against. Laws and regulations from London from this period go on to say that, quote, the better to preserve the peace of his lordship the king, and that each may fear the more to break his peace, it is ordained that if any person shall draw a sword, misericordi, or knife, or any arm, even though he do not strike, he shall pay unto the city half a mark, and remain in the prison of Newgate 15 days, unquote. So, new regulation, even threatening someone with a bladed weapon could see you jailed. And after that, things escalated. Quote, "If he shall draw blood of anyone, let him pay unto the city 20 shillings, or remain in said prison 40 days. And if he shall strike anyone with the fist, even though he had not drawn blood, let him pay the city 2 shillings, or be imprisoned 8 days. And if he shall draw blood with the fist, let him pay unto the city 40 pence, or be imprisoned 12 days. And let such offenders find good surety before their release, and for their good behaviour," unquote. The clampdown by the mayor does seem propelled by, well, it suggests that there was a city filled with endemic violence. But when it comes to crime, we really can't be sure how much was real and how much was motivated by fear. But Henry de Wailer's regulations upon London were not just limited to crime and punishment. He also reorganised the markets, and it's via this time period that we get an idea of how London's retail districts really worked going forward. West Cheap, or Cheapside as it's known today, was the principal retail street. Butchers were to the west in the Newgate area and to the east in East Cheap or East Cheap. Fishmongers congregated in Old Fish Street, south of St Paul's Cathedral, and as Billingsgate specialised more in fishing, in Fish Street Hill. Grain came into Queen Hythe and Billingsgate and to the market at Newgate. Cornhill had a general market, and West Smithfield outside the walls is where most people sold their livestock. The stalls of the fishmongers and the butchers were moved to new locations by the city's fixed stocks on the site of today's Mansion House by St Mary Woolchurch and the Woolbrook River. The rents from the stalls of these new stocks market went in the early days towards the upkeep of London Bridge. They also saw that moving the butchers and fishmongers meant that property was open now for new redevelopment. And there was quite a bit of redevelopment going on in London. The building of Blackfriars Monastery on the site of the old Baynard Castle had necessitated the demolition of the city wall in its vicinity. The precincts of the monastery extended further to the west than the grounds of the old castle. Now, to accommodate them, the king ordered this year that the rebuilt wall should be diverted from the former line south of Ludgate to the Thames, instead it now running along the bank of the River Fleet, now beneath New Bridge Street. More evidence of the clean-up of Cheapside by the mayor is provided by the order of the city that those occupied in melting tallow to make candles were to be removed from that street. They were, however, quote, at liberty to provide themselves elsewhere, if they see fit, unquote. This measure at once removed a fairly stinky occupation and also relocated one of the more obvious fire risks from the region. Mayor Wailes was vigorous and energetic and bold. And at least one source I've read has suggested that this created a degree of hostility towards the mayor from those who should be allied to him, the oligarchs. I've got a problem with that. If you can remember once upon a time when the oligarchical elements of the city had clashed with the commons of London in the great mayoral crisis of the early 1270s, which we covered back in chapter 101, Henry de Wailes was one of the 5 men the oligarchs chose to represent them to resolve the issue. Now, that had been under the rule of Henry III over 11 years previously. But I'm not too sure if there was a clash between the oligarchs and Mayor Wailes. I think it was just more a disagreement maybe between some of them into how things should proceed. London was, as I've explained in many chapters previous to this one, a place that was protective, highly protective of its old rights. Henry de Wailes saw himself as a loyal man of the king and believed he was doing the right thing. Some maybe felt that maybe he was going a little bit too fast and bringing in too many changes, but we certainly don't see any protests in the street over it. What we do see happening in the streets was London getting to enjoy national celebrations. For example, the war in Wales had swung decisively in the favour of King Edward, and his main enemy, Prince Llywelyn, was beheaded. The king sent the Prince of Wales's head to London, and according to the records of London, quote, it was carried through Cheap to the sound of trumpets, unquote. The bodiless head of the enemy of the state being carried through London's principal shopping district to the sound of music sounds like something that wouldn't get a good review on TripAdvisor today, but seemed perfect for the city at the time. And that wasn't all. The residents of London then took the head, quote, and crowned with a silver coronet, after which it was fixed on the pillory there, unquote. And so, we see the defeated enemies of the crown were brought to London in death or in life for mockery and ridicule to celebrate their deaths. Of course, the head of such an important enemy was not allowed to be enjoined by the Londoners forever like this, and reports say the head was eventually, quote, conveyed to the Tower, crowned with ivy, unquote. But now, in the story, we reach the year 1283. The energetic and reforming regime of Mayor Henry de Wailes was still in charge, and he was being aided by the sheriffs Martin Box and Jordan Godcheap. But his administration ran headlong into a moment that shook it and London to the core, and a scandal that was to change the city for over a decade. And to understand this scandal, I have to introduce you to a man known to history as Ralph Crepin. Understand, there is some confusion in the tale that is to follow. As always, in the sources, you'll find this. I've read books that swear blind these events started in 1283 and others that they started in 1284. I just tend to side with those who gravitate towards 1283. Ralph Crepin, also known as Ridolfus de Aldgate, was around the year 1283, 38 years old. He was, by all accounts, London-born and raised, and highly educated. And 9 years previously, back in 1274, Ralph had been appointed the first town clerk of London, a position whose creation I mentioned last chapter, the main civil servant of the London mayoral regime. Ralph had seemingly served this job with distinction and quiet, understated professionalism, working in the administrations of both Gregory de Rooksale and Mayor Wailes. In the summer of 1283, however, Ralph got into an argument with a goldsmith called Lawrence Duckett. It appeared as if Ralph had a mistress called Alice Atibault, and he and Ralph Duckett were given to strong words about the young lady. Such strong words that, by all accounts, Lawrence snapped and attacked Ralph in the street, Ralph suffering serious injury. I could not find the full extent of his injuries, but we can assume it was a physical attack that drew blood, so let's assume that at best it would generate a fine of at least 40 pence, as we described earlier. Lawrence Duckett knew he had messed up for attacking Ralph Crepin on the street like this, and so he had fled and sought and gained sanctuary in the nearby church of St. Mary Le Bow, quote, being pursued thither by certain persons, unquote. Of course he was pursued by certain persons. He'd just attacked one of London's most important shadowy figures. Ralph Crepin had worked alongside the sheriffs and the aldermen of the city for 9 years. He knew everyone. Duckett had just gained himself a serious enemy. Still, Lawrence Duckett had found shelter and safety in the church of St. Mary Le Bow, and there he waited, considering his options. And his options obviously did not look good, as around 5 days after he entered the church, his dead body was found, quote, hanged in one of the windows, unquote, a seeming suicide. Indeed, that was what was thought, because records say that, quote, the coroner's inquest returned a verdict of felo de se, unquote. Felo de se means a crime against yourself. So it was seen as a suicide, and, quote, whereupon the body was dragged thence by the feet and buried in a ditch without the city, unquote. The death of Lawrence Duckett, a foolish goldsmith who had attacked one of London's most important figures and had killed himself at his folly, was investigated by the London authorities and wrapped up in a small, neat little bow. Case closed. However, there was a twist in this tale, and the records say, quote, it so happened, however, that a boy who lay within the church the same night witness the transaction, unquote. And what he reported was that it was not a suicide. The boy had witnessed a group of armed men who had burst into the church and had murdered Duckett for his attack upon the clerk and then faked the suicide to cover their tracks. The revelation, not just of this event, but also of the cover-up, and given it had connections to men such as the Clerk of London, caused, well, a bit of a sensation. And also because the murder had taken place on a church, sacred territory, this escalated things up enormously. The French Chronicle of the City says of this event, quote, "In the same year, for the death of Lawrence Duckett, who was hanged in the church of Our Lady at Arches, seven persons were drawn and hanged. That is to say, Reginald de Lanfer, Robert Pinnett, Paul de Stabheath, Thomas Coroni, John de Tolosane, Thomas Russell, and Robert Scott. A woman, also called Alice Atterbeau, was burnt for the same deed," unquote. Yeah, that's correct, by the way. They hung the men who murdered him, but they burned Alice Atterbeau at the stake for her part in Duckett's murder. But then we read after that, quote, "Ralph Crepin, Jordan Godcheap, Gilbert Leclerc and Geoffrey Leclerc were attained off the felony and remained prisoners in the Tower," unquote. Now, this is huge. You see, Ralph de Crepin is being named as being involved in the murder if he didn't actually commit the murder. But alongside him is Jordan Godcheap. He's one of the sheriffs of London this year. So here we are. We see two crucial parts of the administration of London being named as being not just involved in the murder, but maybe involved in a murder and a cover-up of a murder. Three clerks and a sheriff. This is not a good look, London. A man called John de Bacquel was appointed Clerk of London on the 21st of November, 1284, and held the position through most of 1285 as this case carried on. And it was then said that 16 men, so 11 more than the original seven, were eventually implicated and hung for their part in this crime. The king was said to have been outraged at the murder and the attempt to conceal the truth. And Crepin had his estate seized. And given this, is it any surprise that Henry de Willis was not maintained as mayor of the city and Gregory de Ruxell was returned to his position as mayor, bringing out the former mayor from retirement? But the event did not end there. If anything, this could be said to reveal the endemic corruption and graft going on in London. If this was the case, if everybody working for the mayor was involved, well, if you could use anything to suggest that the oligarchs had been running London like a series of godfathers, this is it. Clearly, something had to be done. King Edward ordered a special judicial commission to be established and placed as a head of it his royal treasurer and troubleshooter and local Holborn landlord, John de Kirby. And in June 1285, John de Kirby summoned the mayor and the aldermen and the sheriffs to turn up in the Tower of London and to attend him over this affair, along with other issues. Like the year before, burglars had forced their way into the Abbey of St. Saviour's down in Southwark that April and stole £68 worth of gold and silver. And it's not recorded if the culprits were caught. So, you know, John Kirby was there formally on behalf of the king to just go, what the hell is going on, London? And we're not 100% sure about what happened next. But I think it's fair to say that at this exact moment in time, Gregory de Ruxell, mayor of London, did something that was incredibly stupid. See, as far as I could surmise, there was some minor technicality in the timing of the summons given to the mayor. Chancellor Kirby had turned up and sent word that the mayor and everyone was to attend him in the Tower of London, like, now. Not yesterday, but immediately. And you see, the usual courtesy was to give the mayor and all the officials a few days' heads up. This minor constitutional faux pas, the mayor decided to make a symbolic objection to. And so Gregory de Ruxell handed over the seal of his office to an alderman, and then went to the Tower and informed de Kirby and all those present that the mayor had not received sufficient notice to attend this gathering. But how can I help you, my lords? It was the kind of minor power game, passive-aggressive nonsense that London had done for years on King Henry III. His problem was, this was the regime of Henry's son, Edward. These were Edward's men, and they were not men given to pissing around. And given his inexperience working for the king, in a high position no less, I am amazed and surprised that Mayor Gregory did this. Maybe he was trying to play for time. Maybe he was stalling to cover up for others in the London political firmament who were involved in the Duckett case. Maybe he really was offended by the immediate summons and thought he'd just make a small point. But for whatever reason, he seriously read that room wrong. John de Kirby was having none of it. So, since there was no mayor to answer the summons, he ruled, London had no mayor. And it was now under the king's direct rule. That's it. Thank you. We'll take it from here. And that was it. The position of mayor had been abolished. It was over. Now, as I said at the start of the episode, we know with hindsight that in 13 years' time, the mayors would be restored. But right here and right now, no one in the city was gifted with such foresight. John de Kirby was now in charge of London. He declared that it was to have a warden running it, and that was that. King Edward and his regime was never going to tolerate the behaviour from the Londoners his father had faced. That objection to the supposed unconstitutional nature of the summons had seen this regime respond forcefully, and the king was not even close to being done. De Kirby informed the leading citizens were to appear before the king at Westminster, and when they appeared, 80 were detained. Ralph de Sandwich was appointed to take over custody of the city. The royal officials were able to continue Henry de Wales' policies and indeed take them much further. Foreign merchants were given full rights in the cities, so breaking up the last of London's old monopolies. Much work was done to bring legal system in London into line with that with the rest of the country, and the city became far more open to intervention by departments of the central government than it had ever been in the past. The wardenship of London was to irrevocably alter the DNA of the city in a way arguably not seen since King Stephen had granted London commune status, a tale we covered all the way back in chapter 62 of the story. And the changes we see over the years are not just legal, but physical. By 1285, for example, it was ordered that a wall should be built around the churchyard and precincts of St. Paul's Cathedral. It was to run from Cheapside along what became known as Paternoster Road to Ave Maria Lane, and then south to Carter Lane, where it turned east, and then went north to Old Change. 6 gates were placed into this wall, the main one being on Ludgate Hill, and these were to be open from dawn until sunset. This wall around St. Paul's, however, long-term listeners may remember, wasn't entirely a new idea. It actually had probably existed before. It was the boundary of the old Paulsbury, the walled enclosure around the church that had existed in Anglo-Saxon and Anglo-Danish times and had possibly made it difficult for King Canute to climb over when he took part in some body snatching, which we covered back in chapter 36. Some changes the new regime carried shades of ancient times, it seems. It should also be noted that later in 1285, we know the king and his officials simply ordered the closure of London's one synagogue, increasing his policy of intolerance towards the Jews. Some changes they were doing were haunted by the passions of current times. And above all things, however, here in 1285, in the cold and damp of that winter, London was beheaded. Like the bridge the Mayor of London, the great symbol of the city, had fallen. Indeed, the collapse of London Bridge is the perfect allegory for London in this era. The mayoralty and the bridge, unique icons of the city, had been broken. As London shivered into the latter part of the 1280s, the city was left blinking as its powers of self-determination, as its agency itself, were removed. London was weakened and reduced. The great rights and victories of their forebears defeated and dashed. And as for King Edward, his revenge upon this damned city was now complete. By the end of 1285, London shivered in the icy grip of the most brutal of the Winter Kings. And worse was yet to come. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you for listening. I do so hope you enjoyed it. The Story of London is a free podcast that runs without adverts, and we continue based on occasional and very well-received donations from listeners who feel that we've done enough to earn a little contribution. You can find a link to the Buy Me a Coffee site where we accept contributions if you so desire. But if you don't, but you do like the podcast and you want to help us in other ways, you can always leave us a nice 5-star review, which actually does a lot to impress the algorithms that automatically present this podcast to new listeners. And if you don't feel like doing that, then that's okay. I just hope you enjoyed the episode and are enjoying the ongoing story of this amazing city. I'll be back next week with another chapter. So until then, this is Saul, hoping that maybe between now and then, summer will arrive. Cheers.